Hey, dear listener, welcome to 10 Laws with East Forest, the podcast. Sorry, this is getting out. Is it a day late, 2 days late? I basically have been on the move, and I did my best to backlog some of these, but this one, I just didn't get it. I did three, but this was a fourth, so I'm getting it out now. I'm actually sitting on the lawn of a group community home of Mikey Siegel in sort of Silicon Valley, just south of San Francisco here, looking over this beautiful, I don't know what to call it, a valley, canyon, sort of undeveloped area. There's an airplane flying overhead, so you might hear some birds, and that's because I'm outside, and I just want to get this done and get this out. So this week, I'm bringing you a conversation I had with Elena Brower. We were in Dallas doing an event together, and she was kind enough to give me a few minutes of her time before our flight, so we hopped over to the Ashton Hotel, which apparently is the hotel that Bill Murray likes to stay in Fort Worth, Texas. It's very nice. It's an old building from the 1930s, so it didn't have a pool, but it had some lovely rooms, and they had this little library that we were able to use, but I had to get them to turn off the Muzak that was playing in the background because that would just be too strange to have that going on while we talk. So we did that. We didn't have a ton of time to talk because we had to get to the airport. So we got about a good 30-some minutes in, and we're going to do more. We're going to do part two with Elena, but this is part one, and we got into some really good stuff already. Elena is someone I've known for quite a while, and fun fact, the very first yoga music thing, live music thing that I ever did was with Elena, and that was back in 2011 on 11-11-11 that some friends put together, Michael Robinson, Sarah Procopio, Louis Kofsky, back in New York City. We did it at the Armory upstairs, and I think we called it the Great Turning, and I just remember showing up, and it's one of those fake it till you make it things, because I did not know anything about yoga, let alone playing music for it. I just was like, yeah. I mean, they asked me to do it. I said, sure. They said, this is Elena. You're going to play music for this class. I was like, let's do it. So we did it. And it's been a beautiful unfolding ever since then and a development. And I've certainly learned when a down dog is and then some. So it's been a beautiful journey. And this was a nice way to kind of come full circle and just look back on some of that and dig into her life and the way she does things, because she definitely has her own viewpoint on that. But otherwise, I'm going to be going to New York City this month in July. I'm playing at the Rockwood Music Hall on July 18th on stage 2 at 9:30 p.m. Advance tickets are only $15. I would love to see some friendly faces there. Please tell your friends. And there's more stuff going on beyond that. It's all at eastforest.org/tour, especially the retreat coming up in September, eastforest.org/retreat in southern Utah. This thing I'm doing right now, to tell you about it briefly, it's pretty cool. It just kind of happened after the 1440 ceremony in Santa Cruz that I was doing with Dana and Marissa. I did the ceremony event, and one of Dana's friends, Mikey, and Nora here, Mikey leads up the consciousness hacking group in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I don't know a whole lot about it because he and I just met, but he was kind enough to invite me out here because he's going to Esalen this weekend and he thought I could help create music for this retreat that they're doing at Esalen, which basically involves using technology to give you forms of biofeedback to essentially deepen our connection to ourselves and others. So we're doing group and individual experiences with electrodes that you put on to measure and your heart rate that you get to hear through not just a subwoofer, but your own headphones. And you can also have a visualization of your heart through like an LED thing in front of you with like multicolors. And we can also do the same thing with breath. So what's really cool about this, though, is that with 24 people all wired up in the room, brought through a Max MSP patch, we got Alex and Ian here. I apologize, I don't have their last names, but I'll get them for you. Ian's been doing this programming so we can, like, you can hear, like, your, if you have a partner, you can hear now your partner's heart rate, and you can pass your LED heart to them and then hear their heart and then hear both of your hearts together and then hear your variability of the two. And it's creative and it's beautiful, and it's a way of amplifying and experiencing and visualizing and using sound to deepen our experience of meditation, of just being alive. So I'm going to be writing some music for that, and we're going to be in the next 3 days just getting deep into development mode to create this experience for the weekend at Esalen. And it's pretty exciting. It's pretty fun to, like, be sitting around Silicon Valley and getting super deep into the tech and bringing an artistic element to it. So I'm really looking for that. It's really fun. Today's sort of day one. I got here last night, and it's really a nice just to have the warm, well, it feels warm to me, the warm ocean air, the fog rolling over the hills after coming from the super dry sun summer solstice of southern Utah. But I've had some other travels and other projects that are in the works, and I'm quite excited to tell you about them, but it's going to have to wait a little bit until these things get a little more developed. But I'm just going to say that as a little bit of a tease, but I'm going to tease. So let's just get into this. This is Elena Brower in Fort Worth, Texas. Enjoy. Okay, thank you. How are you?
Dude, I'm good.
This is a hot day in Fort Worth. We're sitting in a hotel lobby and they just turned off the Muzak so we could talk for a few minutes.
And it was Muzak.
Yeah, it was some smooth jazz. Actually, I was concerned if that was in the background. You'd think no one cares about the rights to that, but it'd be like some Chinese company would write me and say, like,
oh, they'd find
we
you.
Own you.
Yeah, they would find you. I've had that happen.
So, question number one, Elena Brower. I met you when you were a fully formed Elena Brower, but I mean, how does one become such a boss? How does this happen? Like,
I'm so not a boss. I'm Jonah's mom. That's the bossest thing that I do.
Yeah, but you walk in a room, you're a boss. You have a certain energy, and maybe it's just your personality. I don't know. I mean, is that how you've always been?
No, for sure not. I was, you know, the kid with glasses, super skinny legs, and super big feet.
Growing up where?
In Long Island, Raffles Center.
Where's the accent?
I lost it day two at Cornell University when somebody called me out and was like, oh, you're from Long Island. And I was like, ugh.
And you just, like, put the kibosh on that?
I went silent for a couple of days, and I just listened to everybody.
Really?
And I have
you
a facility
just did it manually?
I have a facility for language, and I listened to everybody, and I listened to who sounded like what, and asked a few questions. Where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? And I decided that the most advantageous accent would be one from, you know, Westchester-ish, where there wasn't really one.
Yep.
And that worked out really well. And my best friend from Cornell is straight from Scarsdale, and she and I remain to this day connected at the hip.
I went to college in New York State too.
Where?
Vassar College.
You did. It's a good school, brother.
Yeah, we're below Cornell, but
that's,
yeah,
it's still a great
yeah,
school.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I was coming from Oregon, so I also had a bit of culture shock. The whole Northeast, because I saw a lot of people from Westchester, wherever
yes.
you know, and I didn't know anything about anything when I went to college. Like,
right,
and I got. I feel like I really started to grow up when I was introduced to New York City and all the just different Jews.
Yes.
People of color.
Word.
You know, it wasn't part of my life in
Got
Oregon.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's fascinating. I grew up with all humans in my town. We had everybody there.
Yeah.
And nothing was sacrosanct. Everything was available and all the different communities were represented, and I feel like that was an advantage.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so you correct me if I'm wrong, you got interested in design, right?
Yes, I went to school.
Undergrad.
I studied art history and textiles and apparel. And my dream was to design clothing and fabrics. That was my dream, my big old dream. And I did it. I graduated. I had a job before I even left college. 3 days later, I was standing in front of 1345 Avenue of the Americas with a killer job. 1992.
Designing
woven textiles for Burlington Industries. And this was before NAFTA. So at that time, this was the biggest domestic textile house in the U.S. And it was quite a coveted gig. You know, I got the job while I was still at Cornell, and my salary at the time was $28,000, and that was a lot for 1992.
Yeah, how'd you get that gig? Was it just based on your portfolio?
They recruited on campus.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it was the CEO at the time, Howard. He came and recruited on campus, and it was his whole vibe was awesome. And at the time, Burlington was, like I said, at the top, and it was a really exciting moment because... And here's what was so great about it. There were, I don't know, 9 or 10 other women who were in the realm of my age, maybe 3 or 4 years older, and then a couple years younger, who were doing the work that I was doing, and we were in a team. And it was my first taste of what it feels like to really work in a team of women who were navigating everything, not just emotions, not just professional, you know, ability and skill and capacity, but also this this office where all of us were, you know, having certain roles to play and having to do certain things, and letting strengths come to the surface and letting weaknesses be helped by other people. It was a fascinating experience when I look back on it now, and it was the template in a funny way for all the work that I'm doing now with my doTERRA team.
How so?
Because it helped me to understand the value of, first of all, being willing to make a mistake, say that you're sorry, move on. No grudge holding, no bullshit drama like that. There just is no time for that in a situation like that. And even though, yes, it's only textiles, nobody's going to die. And it's not brain surgery. But we were still servicing a lot of really big accounts at the time. And it mattered how we functioned as a unit.
How many years did you do that?
6 years.
6 years?
Huh. Yeah.
And then, you weren't into yoga at that time?
I was practicing, but there was no
What made the shift? Because now it's like, I mean, such a central part of your life.
It is. I was practicing, like I said, but it wasn't until I left that job and I went to work for a small clothing designer. She was awesome. Her name is Sylvia Heisel, and she had a small business, and I was doing lots of different jobs for her, which was really thrilling to me. Mm-hmm. Everything from photography to, you know, sales. And I learned so much with her. And she was very generous with me and how much she let me do. But I was capable. And then I went to work for Joan and David. And they have since closed down. But that business was, at the time, really just off the apex of its business, of its, like, lifespan as a business. And I moved to Italy. Oh. And during that time, I lived in Italy for almost 2 years, on and off, on and off. And during that time, I discovered that I love yoga. Yoga is the only thing that's going to keep me grounded. A combination of yoga and running, which still is the case.
You run?
Uh-huh.
You know that.
Yeah, like 3-4 times a week.
Where do you run?
It's my medicine. Usually in the Ramble in Central Park.
You do?
Yeah. All up and down there. I get lost every time.
Cool.
It's really nice. And then around the Great Lawn also. But during that time is when I realized... Okay, I live in Italy. I have this very awesome apartment on the Po River in Turin. I'm working at GFT. I'm doing really incredible work. I'm now buying fabric from the guys from whom I used to buy the little swatches to inspire my design work. I'm now buying straight from those guys, which was awesome to make the clothing. And, you know, the quality was incredible, and the whole experience was really important for me. But I realized during that time that I actually don't belong in the clothing business at all, that I belong somehow in service. And during that time, I figured out that what I thought I should have done was teaching art to children. Uh-huh. So I got trained at the New School for a year. And I did half the year as a student teacher with young kids at City and Country, to a private school down in the West Village. And then the second half of the year with like anywhere between, I think, 5 and almost 14 at Village Community School. Slayed that, loved that, like really loved it. But that too, I figured out, was not my calling. And it was during that time that I started to take more yoga classes and found Cindy Lee, who was to be my first, you know, trainer when I was becoming a teacher.
Yeah.
And she's badass. She's still such a force. And she taught me a lot about how I wanted to show up as a teacher, and both reverence and irreverence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's...
That's a good way to describe kind of your energy a bit. Reverence and irreverence.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, I guess, everything. But I mean, you have a quality of definite reverence, but there's a sense of humor to it, you know, where it's like, let's not. Like we were joking today about how we started class.
We can't take ourselves too seriously. But yet, the need for what we're doing is actually real. You know, we have to get into community. We have to share space. We have to take care of each other. We have to make it safe for people to be vulnerable. And we have to make it safe for them to get healed and to heal themselves and mm-hmm. see themselves. And we have to laugh. Did I mention? We have to laugh. It's such good medicine for us.
I was talking last night to, I think it was Rachel, about how a central part of your entire gestalt of everything you do has a visual design to it. I was looking at your book when I was at, I think it was the Practice U one. Mm-hmm. You did all the watercolor and stuff.
I did.
It's beautiful.
I did.
But there's all of your stuff has a real strong sense of design. And I think a lot of people might take that for granted in how it ties together the overall energy and message. Because I feel the same way. I think like the visual element, I'd like to do more of that. I'm not a visual artist, but I know what I like. Mm. And it really helps to make a cohesive whole.
I think it's important for people to, you know, everybody has a different sensibility and a different way to connect to ideas. So some people really connect to the visual. Some people really connect to the movement. Some people really connect to the audio. Some people really connect to the sort of teaching the teacher aspect of it. So I try and make sure that I can reach as broadly as I can.
Yeah.
With as much potency as I can, and then the rest I have to leave. You know, I have to just knives down, hands down, and let it be.
But you do seem to put a lot of attention into the design of everything.
I have a lot of great influences around me, a lot of great teachers. James, my man, my partner, is an incredible artist and has so much knowledge of art history and, you know, walks me through the Met on an almost weekly basis. And we visit.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. And I learned so much about... you know, visual aesthetic with him alone. And he's responsible for creating the cohesiveness that Practice U has. He took all of my art, you know, which was all, basically a couple hundred pieces of watercolor paper, all, you know, scrumbly and crumbly and wrinkling up and curling up. He took it all and created a cohesive...
Oh, no shit. Because it's super tight. I mean, it moves through this whole color scheme, and I start thinking about, like, I wonder if this goes with the chakras or emotions in some way, with the themes of the book, but it's that was cool.
Yeah.
And different shapes and uses of space, but it's all kind of the same simplistic use of color, and yeah, I like that a lot.
I had a lot of heart went into it.
It's almost modern in a way.
Yeah.
Modern watercolor.
It is weirdly like that. A lot of heart went into it. I did it for a few months after my mom passed. Every morning I would just wake up and from 5 to 7 a.m. just rock out. And she was with me every step of the way. And then the book has been such a success. And I think the main highlight I would like to place on this book is the fact that it's being used now with kids.
Yeah.
And teenagers. And even adults in settings ranging from... you know, inquiry, self-inquiry retreats, all the way to juvenile detention centers, to prisons, to yoga teacher trainings. It's being used in all of these different settings to help people just get closer to themselves. That was my dream. Although I didn't know it at the time when I was painting, I was just making a beautiful journal where I would want to write something down because at the time I couldn't even write down what I was feeling. I was so deeply grieving.
Right.
And now I see what it was for.
But there's, it's like workbook, right?
It's a workbook.
And that's another way of saying like the visual element that you were doing was conveying a certain message to it too. There's another example though of how like the aesthetic and the visual is pushing forth the same message that it does in words.
Totally.
Right?
Totally.
Just another way.
And now, funnily enough, we're in the middle of creating a gorgeous 54-card deck of the book where we take a lot of the visuals of the book, but we added another layer of inquiry to each of the most of the cards. And I think it's going to be awesome.
When's that come out?
Most likely the end of this year, the end of 2018.
And you're working on another book right now, but I actually want to ask you about something else first.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, like, that was a practice you did when your mother passed away.
Yeah.
Art. What are some other practices that you find are your kind of your core, especially in the morning?
You know, first thing.
Yeah. What do you do?
I wake up, brush my teeth. Sometimes I take a shower and then always end it with a cold.
Like, oh, you do cold. The cold app?
It's warm and then...
For how long?
Not long. Just enough to like be freezing.
Okay. And be, even in the winter?
Most days. I don't do it every day in the winter. In the winter, I actually won't take a shower.
Why do you do that?
It's really good, first of all, for the polarity, more energetically wise.
Uh-huh.
Energetically, it's for the polarity, magnetism.
Uh-huh.
But secondly, literally for your cell health, the super cold is actually really beneficial. I keep reading it over and over.
I do the cold dunk with my sauna.
That's awesome.
I'm all about those cycles.
Yes,
I mean, boy,
awesome.
When the cold is off,
yep.
That's when it's like the psychedelic boom. Everything's just it's hyper aware. It's beautiful. And you feel great. You're not cold.
There's a definite high that I experience after, you know, getting into that super cold that, you know, you can't get from a drug.
Yeah. Yeah, you experience something similar when you're hiking. You jump in a really cold lake.
Word.
And it's the same thing every time. You don't want to jump in the lake. And then you do, and it's unbelievably invigorating. You get out and you feel like so alive.
Yes.
And it's the greatest lesson in the world. Of like, I always think in my head, it's just like jumping in a cold lake, you know, but anything that I don't want to do or something.
Right.
You know.
That's nice.
Yeah, well, it's great that you start your day with that. It's a sort of reminder, a physical reminder of...
negative ions. I take my acidophilus, I drink a ton of water, and then I do a little yoga practice. Usually it's like anywhere between 10 minutes and an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Just move around, open my hips a little bit.
Put music on or just straight up?
No, straight up, quiet, mm-hmm. quiet, sunrise. And then I chant and I pray and I meditate. And every morning it's the same. I don't chant out loud. I actually, in my mind, chant the Mahamrityunjaya mantra. Three times. I have a series of mantras that I say that my teacher gave me that I'm not meant to say out loud ever, repeat out loud. And then I have my mantra and I meditate with that mantra for anywhere between 10 and 30 minutes, depending on the day.
I was interviewing a woman the other day, Lorraine Weiss, spiritual teacher, and she said something to me that was interesting. When I asked her a similar question, she said something like, well, I used to meditate for 20 minutes a day forever. And the idea being like, she's like, I gave that up.
Oh, funny. She doesn't need it anymore.
And she's also saying like, it's all for her. She's like, I want everything to be in meditation. I don't want to like, this is my meditation time. I have to
and
force
the
world
isn't.
Out. And that's sort of Lauren Roche's sort of, I don't want to summarize his message, but it was something I got from him too. He's like, it's don't feel like you have to whip yourself.
That's right.
You know, and don't feel like everything's like, okay, push in my mind and pushing out the thoughts. You know, I'm going to, and he said, that sounds horrible. That's so hard. And it's like the idea that the beauty and the grace we find in the everyday, that it's everywhere, right? And there's no, and that, I wonder if that can increase our sense of separateness. I've been thinking about these things, but I also value the power of concentration. And I've seen, particularly in psychedelic experiences, how that's been a lifesaver.
For sure.
So I'm like, well, you know, what's right here? You know,
two things come to mind. One is that when I was, you know, let's call it experimenting with drugs, I was always the gal who would try and get as high as possible and be as present as possible. Like, that was my game with myself.
So when you say present, you mean like...
Like, how much
can
I...
We're talking about drugs that lose your mind or... Drugs?
How much can I take and still be cool?
Right. Why did you want that?
This is the big freaking question.
You didn't want to lose control.
What the hell?
Yeah.
But when I sit and meditate, there's a point, there's a trajectory here, I promise. When I sit and meditate, I have the same funny dance with myself where I watch my mind go off in all these different directions, same way it did when I was super high.
Uh-huh.
And fine, you know, sometimes it's a little dark, but most of the time my life is pretty good. I've organized myself really well. I've been diligent for the past several years, and now I have things well in order for the most part. And I don't have any grudges or, you know, things that I regret hanging over my head. None of that is true.
Mm.
But when I'm meditating, I feel the same little wrangling of control of my mind. And I just, every moment that I can, release it. I give it to the mantra. I give it to presence. I give it to source, whatever I can do to give it away. And my mind gets still. It's not, Lauren says it properly, and I love his teaching, and my teacher, Yoga Guru Bharat Stryker, says the same thing. It's really not about quieting the mind. It's about just letting it get still. Having something else to focus on, like your mantra or a mudra or bandhas, lets your mind get still. You don't want to get rid of what's in there. There's some good, valuable information in there, for sure.
Yeah, and the ego, like, our mind is beautiful.
It's a tool.
It's important, yeah.
It's not a problem. It's a tool.
Yeah.
But it has to be treated as a tool, not the most potent, you know, priority, nor is it a problem.
So also, speaking of, like, cultivating that other side of the stillness, your larger mind, the quiet mind, it's sort of to help you... Imagine if the average person who has no experience with it, they only identifying with their mind, their thinking mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they might not even have this. I mean, even my father, maybe he was a bit of a rationalist, materialist. He might be like that, but that's, it's like Descartes. Like, I think,
sure.
Therefore I am.
It's all a part of it. And the question for me is, I really now love and savor and feel truly harmonious when I'm sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And that now is becoming more and more of who I am and how I show up in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
I still get mad at my kid, but not like I used to, and not with the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I still get frustrated with things at work and not with the frequency and not like I used to. And so the quality of the meditative mind is starting to take a hold. It is starting to accrue and accumulate, and I am feeling, you know, after whatever it's been, 15 years or something, I'm feeling the effects of it finally. And I do feel like it's very beneficial to me, at least.
15 years? You didn't feel benefits before?
No, because I was still getting high. Up until 4 years ago, when I got sober, I was still getting high. And so I would fall in and out of it, but it wasn't something that I was able to be consistent about because I wasn't keeping my word to myself. And when you're not keeping your word to yourself, here's the gold. It's hard to sit down with yourself and just be still.
Say more about keeping your word to yourself.
I'm definitely going to do this, and then you don't do it. I'm definitely going to stop doing that, and then you keep doing it.
So literally what you're telling yourself and not following through.
Correct. It's really hard on the body.
Well, you're also not stepping into your own inherent power, and the only thing stopping you is
you.
Choice.
Is you.
Yeah.
And I can see it. You know, I see it everywhere. I see it in myself. Certain days when I say something I'm going to do and then I don't do it, it sucks. It's the worst feeling. And then the days that I do what I've said that I would do, the best. Just the best. It is so, life is actually so simple. And yes, people get sick and all around me. My friends who are my age are getting sick like crazy. It's so bizarre. And things, really bad things happen. But the more we can be very simple and just keep our word to ourselves, also to other people, but to ourselves, the easier it is to exist in the world and be capable functioning.
Like the Four Agreements, the first one is about that. You always speak the truth, but essentially the same idea is like, your word is your word, is the word. It's like, if you can do just that one agreement, it's like your whole life could change.
I feel, I'm living proof of that. My life has become a lot nicer since I made that a priority.
And how do you define nicer? How's your world
just
nicer?
Just easier. You know, I find it easier to allow...
Less sticky for what comes
less
up?
Less sticky, less grudges, fewer disagreements. You know, something comes up, it didn't work, I made a mistake, I fucked something up, I just apologize, we move forward, the current keeps flowing through, you know? There's no, very little anyway, holding on to things or trying to get something. It's just let it flow, you know, and act with diligence and vigilance, but let it flow.
Mm. It's hard. I think sometimes the truth is not so black and white.
It's just what's true in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Truth is very different from person to person. When you get, I do a fair amount of mediating, probably once every couple of weeks, amongst folks on my team or anyway, even with my kid. And it's easy to see how the capital T truth is totally misconstrued. And all we can deal with and all we can count on is what's your truth in this moment and what's my truth in this moment. They're two very different things. How do we respectfully hear each other, acknowledge each other, maybe even agree to disagree and move forward? It doesn't matter what the capital T truth is. That's for, you know, not for us to decide. But at least if we can start to, you know, get on knowing that everyone has their own truth and we can all coexist with all these different truths, everything kind of gets a little more simple.
Is that a level of acceptance?
For sure.
I'm trying to be the best way to give it a word.
Yeah. I think it's even more allowance. Like, how do I allow this person with whom I do not agree at all to have his or her opinion?
What about doing that with your own mind, like the inner critic?
My inner critic cruised the minute my mother died. It's so rare that I feel
I'm
that way.
I'm smiling because you're like, first off, a couple people I've talked to have talked about their inner critic not being very present, and they're all women. And Amanda was one.
Right.
Marissa was one. And, right. And I'm just like, it's so confounding to me because like that's such a strong voice in my head. I don't mean like this presence that's beating me, but it's like...
I see.
I think it's how I grew up.
Dude, you got to get rid of that, dude.
Well, great. I'd love to. You know, I work with it. I'm not saying you're right, but I noticed that I had a lot of latent negativity growing up.
Toward yourself.
Well, that's how the world is viewed.
Oh, I see.
So it's like that's how I learned to understand life.
You know what would be fun? Dare I give you advice?
Please.
Right now, pardon me. A men's group. Do some men's work.
Yeah.
That's the best kind of
work. I just started a dream group with some men, and it is basically a men's group, but I wish it was a little more regular. Well, I travel so much, but it's
been... You can always Skype in. What's good about it, and I see it in James, because he's very, very... committed to it. He goes every Wednesday and he always comes home real powerful.
I would love that. Yeah.
It's so good because you get to see other men. You're exactly, you know, in company. You're exactly the same. And so you get validated, and in the validation and in the voicing of it, it begins to lose its charge.
Right, right.
And its hold
it's
on
a,
you.
It's not a secret, or it's not like this inner thing. It's more like aired out, you know.
Mold can't grow.
It probably seems not as important once you talk about it.
Well, mold can't grow in the sunshine. I talk about this a lot. Like, if you put it out in the sun, mold's going to die.
Yeah.
Dries out. Same thing. It's almost like, and James has a lot. You wouldn't believe the stories that he, you know, in his household and the sort of negativity that was swirling around him. And he is emerging, this guy, 51 years old. It is the
That's
most
awesome.
Beautiful thing. To see, and he recognizes where this voice is that, and this one is that, and he is plowing, you know, ahead.
I can see that. Like, I can see where it's coming from, and that took a long time. It's internal work, and it gets less credence because of that. So I definitely have that mindfulness of like, well, I'm just watching it sometimes, but boy, you know, I've dealt with depression and It's come up in my life a few times in really big ways, and it's so hard because it's essentially a story, but it gets like a snowball.
Yeah.
And it gets an energy where it becomes it's almost physical and unconscious, and it gets this energy to it that's very difficult to just shift out of.
It becomes an entity. The things that we're doing today in class, we did a little bit of acupressure for emotional healing, and we did a couple of things. I know you were.
I have to say, you touched a girl and said something. She literally fainted in about 5 seconds when you touched like a spot on her body.
Yeah,
and it was profound.
It wasn't just.
I know. I'm making it light of it, but it was.
But it was.
I think it probably you moved energy. You know, some energy was moved there physically.
She was in the middle of moving some energy.
Right, right.
Which I could feel. And so I was drawn to her.
Yeah.
And I was there to basically support her. And thankfully, I walked over when I did because she literally buckled. But anyway, the point is we were doing acupressure. And again, it comes to the simplest things. In moments like that, for you, if you're listening to this and you are suffering with any sort of depression or real mental
turbulence,
yeah, thank you.
Friction.
That's friction is the word I was looking for. Little points on your body that you just put a hand on, a little fingertip on, can in fact move the energy from where it is to somewhere else. And really these mental conditions are stagnations, as far as I am coming to understand. And I've been really,
mental conditions are stagnations.
Most. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're just stagnation of energy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've had depression in my family. I've seen it firsthand. Mm-hmm. And I see how it's a thought, an idea, an experience that then gains traction in one's mind mm-hmm. by being repeated, mm-hmm. by then being buffeted and let's say, built on by the folks around you.
It's a story that gets larger and larger.
I was not using the word story because I don't want to diminish people who have depression or really suffering, and I don't want to diminish it.
Well, I'm speaking from firsthand experience. I was thinking about grief when mm-hmm, you said that mm-hmm. and how grief can turn into depression. I mean,
that
something I went through
is
recently,
fair.
Right?
That is fair.
But all of these are just ideas, right? I mean, where is that line between I'm grieving versus I'm depressed? It's just how you want to identify with your experience. I think depression, I think of it when I feel it's suddenly, I don't know if this is the right way to describe it, out of my control. Mm-hmm. Or it's more like it is now owning me in a way.
Yes.
Versus grief, I'm working with it in a sense.
That's fair. I you know, the whole time that after my mom died, I really had a couple of choices, a couple of key moments where I was like, right, how am I gonna do this? My mom's gone.
Yeah.
Who the hell am I now? Yeah. What is left here?
Is it a panicky feeling?
It was very panicky at the beginning. And then I started to realize, okay, I have choices. I get to bring full on luminosity to this thing and help other people and be vocal about it and go through it vulnerably, but also publicly, but also honestly, or hide, sad, grieving, fucked.
So moving that energy outward, whether it's helping other people was a key point. It's like, that's classic karma.
It's classic
recovery.
Like,
if you want to feel whatever, go help other people feel that.
If you want to, our Uber is here.
Yeah,
if you want to be successful in recovery, go serve someone else. If you want to be successful in moving a state out of your being, go serve someone else with it. Go help somebody else who's suffering from it. That's
it's golden rule, and it's like we got to remember these things.
Word.
I know we got to go. I could do this for a long time.
We will do. You know,
pick
we'll
it
just
up
do it again.
Or something.
We'll
know,
do it again.
Yeah,
we'll do it again. It's gonna.
I'm
be
already
awesome.
Like I'm so deep in this. But,
I know. All right.
Thank you. All right. Well, there it is. Thank you. Thank you, Elena, for taking some time. We will get some more with her. We'll do a part two at some point, and we just need to get on the old Zoom and hammer it out. This song you're hearing in the background is actually called For Elena, and that's because she and I did a meditation series. It's her meditation series, and I helped her produce it and did the music for it. And so the song that I kind of developed for her that was the main meat, the background of the meditation, this is sort of it.
And that's why I called it For Elena, because it kind of came from her project. And it's on the song Music to Die To, I believe. Or is it Music to Be Born To? Might be Music to Be Born To. They're sister records anyway, so check it out. Thank you for listening. Thank you for reviewing. Just go down there. It makes a big difference. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. And if you do, hey, you do it with...